From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Writer's Life, we talk with two writers about their work. First, Fran Lebowitz. After becoming famous for her humorous writing, Lebowitz became famous for her writer's block. Now she's finally back at work on a novel. She'll tell us about writing and not writing. Then Anne Lamott talks about her book of advice for writers. And what's country western music got to do with jazz? Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Hillbilly Fever Volume 1, Legends of Western Swing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Supreme Court has rejected a challenge to a federal law protecting access to abortion clinics. The justices let stand a ruling in a Virginia case that found the law does not infringe upon anyone's right of free speech. Anti-abortion activists had claimed that the year-old law, designed to reduce violence and intimidation at clinics, serves to inhibit peaceful protests as well. In another decision, the justices ruled that organizers of Boston St. Patrick's Day Parade have a right to exclude groups from participating. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1992, a group calling itself the Irish American Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Group of Boston sought to participate carrying a banner identifying itself in the same manner as other groups. The war veterans refused to let them in, and the gay group went to court, claiming that their exclusion violated the state's public accommodation law against discrimination in public places based on sexual orientation. The state courts agreed and ordered the gay group to be included in the parade. But today, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously reversed the state courts and sided instead with the war veterans. Writing the court's unanimous opinion, Justice David Souter said the state court's decision had violated the fundamental rule of the First Amendment, that the speaker has the autonomy to choose the content of his own message and, conversely, to decide what not to say. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The United Nations Security Council has condemned the Bosnian Serbs for blocking shipments of emergency supplies to Muslim enclaves. Bosnian government troops appear to be shifting their positions around Sarajevo to try to keep their offensive against Serb supply lines alive. Russia's military commander in Chechnya reportedly blocked the buses carrying Chechen rebels and their civilian human shields and forced the convoy to take a longer route to Chechnya. The rebels left the southern Russian city of Budanovsk after releasing hundreds of hostages they'd been holding at a hospital. The BBC's Robert Parsons reports from Budanovsk.
After hours of tortuous negotiations in which one moment the deal seemed to be on and then off again, some 100 Chechen fighters drove out of Budanovsk Hospital in a convoy of 7 buses. They've taken with them around 100 hostages who volunteered to go with them as guarantors of their safety, 16 journalists and 8 Russian members of parliament. The convoy drove through successive rings of heavily armed Russian troops in a cloud of dust and blazing sunshine. Large crowds of local people shouted and cheered from the sides of the road, but just as many looked anxiously in the direction of the hospital. As part of the agreement hammered out by the Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin and the Chechen commander Shamil Basayev, the Chechens left most of the remaining hostages, several hundred of them, in the city hospital.
The BBC's Robert Parsons. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just over 41 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Transportation Department has announced plans for sanctions against 2 Japanese airlines in retaliation for the failure of Japan to allow Federal Express to fly between Japan, the Philippines, and other points in Asia. The sanctions would limit the goods that can be carried from Japan to the U.S. on cargo flights by Japan Airlines and All Nippon Cargo Airlines. A top Japanese trade official says he is pessimistic that talks later this week will head off the threatened 100% tariffs the U.S. plans to impose on many Japanese-made luxury cars starting next week. California Governor Pete Wilson today opened a presidential campaign office in Des Moines. Wilson is not an official candidate yet, but he plans to announce later this summer his intentions to run for president. Mark Moran from member station WOI reports from Des Moines.
The California governor is trying to establish a strong presence in Iowa, site of the nation's first presidential caucuses next February, though he admits the race here is likely for second place. Most Iowa Republicans have already lined up behind U.S. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, who announced his candidacy several months ago. Dole has a healthy lead in public opinion polls. But Wilson claims he'll do the kind of grassroots campaigning necessary to be a successful politician here. But his moderate Republican message could fall on deaf ears in Iowa, a state increasingly controlled by conservative members of the GOP. Though he has not formally announced his candidacy yet, Pete Wilson has unofficially joined a crowded field of Republican presidential hopefuls, which includes Dole, former Tennessee Governor Lamar Alexander, and Texas Senator Phil Graham. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Work crews are pumping fuel off the American Queen, the largest river steamboat ever built, to help lighten its load and free it from the sandbar where it has been beached in the Ohio River since Sunday morning. The Coast Guard is making plans now to evacuate the 285 passengers aboard the ship. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fran Lebowitz was hailed as one of the wittiest writers of her generation after the publication of her two best-selling books, Metropolitan Life in 1978 and Social Studies in 1981. But soon after that second bestseller, Lebowitz became famous for her writer's block, which lasted over a decade. She's writing again, working on a new novel and a sequel to her first children's book. Last year, essays from her first two books were collected in the anthology, The Fran Lebowitz Reader, and her children's book, Mr. Chass and Lisa Sue Meet the Pandas, was published. After their publication, we invited her to talk about writing, and not writing. We started with a reading from an essay in her collection. These are variations on the theme of not writing, the topic that she says preoccupies most writers.
Variation on this theme number one. You can't write. You call another writer. He can't write either. This is terrific. You can now talk about not writing for 2 hours and then go out to dinner with each other until 4 o'clock in the morning. Variation on this theme number two. You can't write. You call another writer. He is writing. This is a great tragedy. He will talk to you only as long as it takes for him to impress upon you the fact that not only is he writing, but he thinks that what he is writing is quite possibly the best thing he's ever written. Your only alternative to suicide in this situation is to call a rock musician. This makes you feel smart again, and you can get on with the business of not writing. Variation on this theme number three. You are writing. Another writer calls you to talk about not writing. You announce that you are. Masochistically, he inquires as to what it is that you are writing. You inform him modestly that it's just a little something vaguely reminiscent of, say, an ideal husband, perhaps a bit funnier. Your behavior at his funeral the following day is marked by enormous dignity and grace.
Fran, when did you write that?
I think I was in my 20s. I'm in my 40s now.
Are the feelings expressed in that reading still feelings that you have?
Actually, not, in the sense that I don't think about other writers at all anymore, which I guess I did then. If my life was more collegial at that time, by which I mean I hung out in bars all the time, and so that I think I had more contact with other people in that way, perhaps more competitive in the sense of were they getting work done. Now I just assume everyone is getting more work done than I am, and I go from there.
It's interesting because you became famous for your writing, and then you became famous for not writing. In a way, it's really quite a racket. I mean, you're very famous for not doing something. Can you make a living not writing?
I did. Barely. I mean, you don't do very well. Let's put it that way. No, I didn't make a living not writing, but I managed to make a living even though I wasn't writing.
Doing what?
Talking. Mostly what I did during the several thousand years that I wasn't working was I did a seriously inordinate number of college lecture dates, by which I mean almost nonstop. And so I just talked. I read from my old books, which were getting older and older. and then I would answer questions from the audience in an entertaining fashion. And I did that. I went from college to college. I was the Willie Loman of literature. It was a very depressing period of my life.
So we're talking about this in the past tense. It's ended?
Yes, it's been ended for about 2.5 years.
And you're writing what?
I'm writing a novel.
Called?
Exterior Signs of Wealth.
Now, that's the novel you said you were writing in the early 80s.
Yes, that's the novel that I was supposed to be writing when I finished social studies. The idea was that I would now write this novel called Exterior Signs of Wealth. But then I stopped writing. So when I started writing again about 2.5 years ago, it was the same title and in certain respects the same novel, although, of course, not at all the novel I would have written then.
What changed that made you able to write again?
And I really don't know. I mean, just as I don't really know exactly why I couldn't write, but perhaps in some way my fear of writing became eclipsed by my fear of not writing. You know, 10 years, that's serious. You know, you begin to say, well, this is serious. And also, I think that what happened was it became harder work not to write than to write. And so I went with the easier thing.
Well, what do you like and what do you hate about writing?
Well, I used to say that I liked nothing about writing, that what I liked about writing was having written. But now, in my middle years, I actually find writing to be, if not really pleasurable, at least more interesting than the rest of life. This probably is a function of my age. I mean, life is more interesting than writing when you're young, and life is newer. Now, I think it's more entertaining, at least to me, to reflect upon it than actually to have to live it. I mean, I don't know. I once, Toni Morrison told me that she liked to write very much, and I said, why? And she said, because without writing, you're stuck with life. And that does become, or it has become true for me.
So could you talk a little bit about what the new novel is about, or would you prefer not to?
Oh, it's not that I prefer not to. It's kind of hard to describe. I mean, it's not a book that's easily described. I mean, I always think a book that's easily described is A Shark Came and Ate Everyone. It's a... It takes place over 20 years. It starts in 1971. It ends in 1990. It has, unlike most contemporary fiction, it has a large number of characters in it. I mean, something that's always struck me about contemporary fiction is, doesn't it seem to you like almost everyone in, all the characters in contemporary novels know practically no one? There are never more than four or five people in a book, and they only know two or three people. And although I would consider this to be a very happy state of affairs in reality, it's not true, I think, in most people's lives. So it has a great many characters, not a lot of plot, and it's set largely in New York, although there are scenes set elsewhere. It is meant to be funny, although not to the same extent that my essays were. In other words, I mean, that's not my primary concern while I'm writing it. And it's about a lot of things, including kind of the end of bohemianism, which I think is no longer a real possibility in this country.
Why not?
Because the media finds everything in 14 seconds, you know, no matter what it is. And because kids are so aware of it and so self-conscious that nothing truly marginal has a chance to really grow in any way before it's, you know, picked up in 1 second by some big magazine or something.
Let me say something that I've never quite understood about you. On the one hand, when I hear you talk, I always think of you as somebody who could probably live a solitary life just fine and doesn't really care what anybody thinks. And on the other hand, when I read about you, it's often in the context of some kind of scene, you know, being at a party or your views on the nightlife or something. I've never been able to reconcile the part of you that's gone to so many parties with the part of you that seems to me to exist as this kind of like solitary person not caring what others think.
I am both.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm alternately, unusually, and even gratuitously gregarious. On the other hand, I'm really very solitary. I've lived alone my entire life. My entire adult life. I've lived alone since I was 17. I would never consider living with another human being. It'd be out of the question. And when I'm not at a party or out in that way, I'm by myself reading. But I like both things. I mean, both things are important to me. At this point in my life, I would prefer to spend more time by myself. And especially when I'm really working on my novel, which I haven't been since I've been selling books as opposed to writing them. I rented a house in Princeton, and I stayed there for 14 months, and I very rarely came to New York. And I very rarely saw anyone at all. And I found it a very pleasurable experience.
Hmm. When you say you wouldn't ever live with anybody, not even a lover...
Especially not.
So do you find that it makes for a good relationship to not live together?
No.
That doesn't work either.
No. having good relationships in the way that you mean it has not been a priority in my life.
Oh, okay.
You know, I am the only person in my generation who doesn't think that you get to have every single thing in the world all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or even ever. No, I'm sure that to have a very good relationship or a very good marriage, you have to devote quite a bit of attention to it. It's out of the question that I would be willing to do that.
Right.
So that, no, I don't think that probably is a good idea.
I'm interested in your writing habits. You know how some writers have like a couple hours every day where they sit down and write, and they're very disciplined about it.
Yes, I've read about them.
Have you ever tried that? Has that ever worked for you?
Well, I've always, that's the thing I really envy. For instance, they sent me all at once every Paris Review ever printed. And what did I do? I sat in my apartment for a month, read every single one. But what I was really interested in reading the Writers at Work series were things like how many hours a day did other writers write?
Mm-hmm.
And how much writing did they get done?
And how much is enough for a day?
And I'm always, you know, I actually don't have that many friends who are writers. And when I meet writers, that's the only thing I want to ask them. I mean, the fact is that if I met Proust, I would say, so, how many words do you get a day? You know, and do you write in the morning or at night? And do you think if you write in the daytime, you have more chance of getting more work? That would be my only interest. So that I, when I was living in Princeton, I was really getting work done. I worked in kind of two periods, you know, during the course of the day. I never, ever sat at a desk before 3 o'clock in the afternoon in my life. I mean, not since there was algebra homework on that desk, you know, not since I was a child. And then I would write from like 3 to like 7, and then starting again maybe about 10 to 4 or 5 in the morning.
Hmm.
I always have had a habit of writing at night. When I was in Princeton, I tried also to write in the afternoons, since I realized that there was no point in just sitting around all day waiting for night to come, which is what I'd done most of my life. And it gave me gives you a second chance, so you don't feel so depressed if you don't get anything done the first time around. You know, but I've always found it easier to write at night, I suppose, because I'm more alert, first of all. And it just seems quieter.
No, I think in every writer, there's the writer and the editor. And sometimes the editor can choke the writer because you pick up, you know, you start writing, you go, oh, not good enough. Start over again. Oh, not good enough.
I don't think there's a difference. The uh-huh. writer and the editor. I mean, writing is editing.
But I mean, is there... is there a part of you that you have to turn off in order to write, in order to, like, get out the sentence, and then you kind of summon back the editor to groom the sentence afterwards?
I've never been able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, inside of me is a Nazi general.
You
know? I mean, there, and that's why, you know, I write a sentence a day. No, the editor is not only present in me, but omniscient. We don't go on to the next syllable, to that previous syllable is perfect. So that I'm sure that I would write more if I was less critical of myself. But I am, you know, I'm just as critical of myself as I am of others. So that's pretty harsh.
Is that one of the things that makes it so hard to write?
It's one of the things that makes it so hard for me to write.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think you should make it hard for yourself to write so that you're easier to read. If you're easy on yourself when you write, you're going to be hard to read.
So it wouldn't work for you to just sit down and you know, let it flow, just write, not worry about how it reads, and then come back again another day and be really critical and edit it and rewrite it and so on.
Well, you know, I think that I don't write in drafts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that partially that's just a habit. You know, it's like saying I write with a pen as opposed to a pencil or... but part of it is that when, you know, one of your chief concerns, if not your chief concern, is style, it's really impossible to do that. Writing in drafts is for people who have either information to extend to the reader, which I don't, or emotion. You know, I don't know, that must be the reason people do it. I'm simply unable to do that. You know, it's not that I think this is a better way to write, or, you know, or a worse way to write. It just, I would be unable to do that. I mean, my concern for, first of all, when you're writing things that have the intent to be humorous, you have very few tools at your disposal. And the primary tool that you have, other than what you're saying funny, is the rhythm of it. So that mostly what I'm doing when I'm writing is counting syllables, so that the rhythm of the sentence is right. So if I replace a word, I have to replace it with a word of the same number of syllables. This, I realize, sounds probably totally insane to the people who are listening, but a lot of the time when I'm writing, that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So that, and I constantly read aloud to myself, you know, while I'm writing. So it's just not really possible for me to write in drafts like that, although I'm sure I would get more work done.
Fran Lebowitz is my guest, and she has a new book called The Fran Lebowitz Reader, which is a kind of Fran Lebowitz's greatest hits kind of book. And she has a book for kids also called Mr. Chass and Lisa Sue Meet the Pandas. Fran, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air.
Fran Lebowitz is my guest. Her book, The Fran Lebowitz Readers, collects some of her earlier essays, and she has a new children's book called Mr. Chass and Lisa Sue Meet the Pandas. If you don't know, if you don't mind my asking, you're in your, what, early 40s now? Mid-40s?
I'm 44.
44. Does being 44 bother you at all? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you get a gray hair, do you care? If you see wrinkles on your face, does that bother you?
First of all, I've had gray hairs since I was about 17.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're not at all surprised. But, you know, it turns out that my gray hair was just a phase. I don't have it anymore.
You outgrew your gray
I
hair.
I outgrew it. So, you know, it just came and went.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, I can't stand getting older. I mean, I don't know anyone who likes it. Mainly because I think, or it seems to me, that I at least at some point in my life felt that age was immutable. In other words, I think that I thought, well, there's all kind of people in the world, you know, young people, old people, tall people, short people, black people, white people. And I guess I thought that I was like young people, old people, that I was like a short, young, white one. And that this was going to be the case forever.
That was your condition.
Right. And I don't know what did I think about other people that, boy, they're not very smart shoppers. Look at the body that they got. I got this 20-year-old body. They got that 40-year-old body. So that I think I was astonished to discover that it wasn't going to stay that way. And, you know, I can't say that I've welcomed it. I can't say that from a physical point of view, no one likes getting older. I actually noticed, since I've been on this book tour for about 80 weeks, that I actually, a lot of people notice they start to look like their mothers, for instance. I just skipped that phase. I look just like my grandmother now. I went from looking just like myself to looking like Lily Splaver in one fell swoop. And then I had dinner with my cousin in Chicago, and I said, I look like grandma now, don't I? And she said, yes, you do. That's where I am now from a physical point of view.
So what do you do with that feeling? I mean, do you feel like, well, I'm going to look like my grandmother with attitude, with defiance, I don't care? Or do you think, well, I'm going to be really depressed about this, or I will cosmetically change myself through makeup or plastic surgery? You know what I'm saying? Like, what do you do with that feeling?
Well, here's what I do about it. I look in the mirror and I think, you look better now than you're ever going to look again. And you're going to... If you have a picture taken of yourself today, in 5 years, you're going to look back and say, you look so young. You look fabulous. However, except for the look part of it, I like being older otherwise. I mean, there are advantages to it. First of all, everyone who's in charge of everything is someone you know. This is very helpful. This I like. And so I find that quite an upside. It doesn't balance it out. You know, uh-huh. I would rather, of course, be 20. But you don't get that choice, so you might as well take advantage of some of the upside of things. And there's certainly less urgency in life, which I also welcome. Now, a lot of people don't like being this age because it's certainly less exciting, but I'm happy to have it be less exciting.
So are you going to obsess about how you look, or are you going to not care about it?
Well, it isn't that I don't care about it. I'm pretty vain. It's just that, what can you do about it? I mean, you mean, am I going to have a facelift and stuff like that? I don't think so, because I think it's better to look like an earthling, don't you? I have no moral opposition to facelifts, but they only work for a couple years, uh-huh. And then you get this kind of Neptunian quality to your face. So I don't think that they don't have all the kinks out yet, as far as I'm concerned. I just don't think there's not that much at our disposal to do that much about it. So I kind of accept it. Also, I'm a heavy smoker. You know, there's a chance. How much further is this going to go? You know, I mean, that a lot of people worry about being really old. You know, I mean, actually an old person, like a 90-year-old person. And I don't worry about this too much.
I figure you've probably lost a lot of friends to AIDS. I'm just wondering, correct me if I'm wrong, but I just assume that you've had a lot of friends who have died. And if that's so, I was wondering how that's changed you, if at all, and changed what you want or what you expect out of life.
Well, I certainly have known a very large number of people who died of AIDS. I mean, really a large number, but hundreds of people. Only one very, very close friend has died of AIDS, but quite a few, you know, second-tier friends. Like, one of my best friends died. It's changed my life more than anything else has ever changed my life. It's changed my life tremendously. Not only for the reasons, personal reasons, which of course it makes you reassess things, etc., but also because it changed the culture so much. and particularly the cultural environment that I lived in, changed it completely. It disappeared. It completely disappeared. You know, an entire sensibility disappeared, an entire world, you know, but a world that I lived in disappeared.
Which specific world was that?
I mean, this certain kind of sensibility is gone. That was a kind of, it's hard to describe. People like, say, Charles Ludlam died. Mm-hmm. My friend Peter Hujar died. Antonio Lopez. I mean, these are all people that I was close to, that I knew really well, that I knew not only personally, but, you know, that kind of created the environment that I lived in. And it was political environment, you know, a sexual environment that was sex without politics, you know, homosexuality without gay politics. That doesn't exist anymore. It's disappeared. It was, you know, now, of course, people say it was a ghetto sensibility, which it was to a certain extent. It was a marginal sensibility for sure. And it was a harbinger sensibility. In other words, you know, you may think, I don't mean you specifically, one might think Charles Ludlam would have no relationship to the larger culture at all. But in fact, of course he did. It just took 20 years. All the people like that really affected the culture in a very slow way. In the interim, that was a separate environment that I lived in, and that's just completely gone.
So do you feel that there's less of a place for yourself now?
No place at all.
Reasons?
Uh-huh. No public place at all. It doesn't exist. I don't have that type of life at all anymore. Zero. It doesn't exist.
Will AIDS figure into the novel that you're writing?
Yeah, of course it does. But in no way is it an AIDS novel.
Right.
I mean, not by the furthest stretch. But of course it does. I mean, but it doesn't define it the way that I think people might expect it to. Mm-hmm. I have a certain objection to making a great metaphor out of AIDS. I think it's dangerous to do that. And I also think that in the end, it's not accurate. It is, no matter who makes that metaphor, largely the metaphor, the AIDS metaphor has been made by AIDS activists in their rush to not allow someone else to do that to it. I think it's quite important to remember that it's a virus. That's all. It's a virus.
Well, Fran, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fran Lebowitz. Her essays are collected in the anthology The Fran Lebowitz Reader. Our interview was first broadcast in January of this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, swing music, Western style. This is Tulsa Twist by Dickie McBride and the Village Boys on a new collection called Hillbilly Fever. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review. And writer Anne Lamott tells us about the advice she gives her students and the strategies she's developed for herself to keep writing even when she thinks she can't. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Chechen hostage takers have reportedly been forced to take a longer route back to their homeland after a Russian military commander blocked the planned path of the bus convoy. The Chechen rebels released hundreds of hostages they had been holding in Budyonovsk after the Russians agreed to a promise of safe passage. But the rebels took a number of so-called volunteer hostages with them as insurance. NPR's Anne Garrels reports from Moscow.
What we've been told is that the people who've accompanied the Chechen fighters are medical staff, Russian journalists, and civilians. However, we're not at all sure that these are only volunteers, as Russian Prime Minister Chernomyrdin insisted. The curtains of the buses were closed as the buses pulled out of Budyonovsk. It was hard to see exactly who was who, although Reuters reports that one girl saw her father in the bus and clearly did not think he was a volunteer, although he may well have been in an attempt to just get the hospital cleared of people.
NPR's Anne Garrels in Moscow. The Supreme Court has ruled that the law that protects access to abortion clinics does not infringe upon the free speech rights of anti-abortion protesters. Among other rulings today, the justices rejected efforts by the adoptive parents of baby Richard to regain custody of the child. The Illinois couple had raised him for nearly 4 years before surrendering him to the boy's biological parents. And the High Court rejected an Arkansas couple's argument that their huge Christmas displays with millions of lights were protected by freedom of religion provisions. The justices let stand a ruling requiring the couple to tone down the display, which neighbors complain is disruptive. Hungary's president has been reelected by parliament for a second 5-year term, but as Stefan Boss reports from Budapest, the Hungarian leader has predicted a difficult future for his country.
In his acceptance speech, the newly elected Hungarian president Árpád Gunc warned for more economic difficulties as Hungary moves towards a modern market economy. But Mr. Gunc says he wants to work closely with parliament to ensure Hungary's smooth transition. His re-election was backed by the two governing Hungarian Socialist and Free Democrats parties, but challenged by a candidate of the center-right opposition. Mr. Gunc became Hungary's first democratically elected president 5 years ago after 40 years of communism. Mr. Gunc, who is 73, served 6 years of a life sentence because of his part in the 1956 revolution, which was crushed by Soviet soldiers. For National Public Radio, this is Stefan Bos in Budapest.
Stocks were on a roll again on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 40 points to close at 4270.09, a new record high. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 13-9 and heavy trading of 322 million shares. This is NPR News. Israel's prime minister wants the Palestinians to back off their demand for a complete troop withdrawal from the occupied territories. Yitzhak Rabin says Israel is only willing to negotiate a redeployment in parts of the West Bank now, to be followed by Palestinian elections. The Palestinians have been insisting on a commitment for a two-stage complete Israeli withdrawal from all West Bank towns as a prerequisite for elections. In India, a heat wave has killed as many as 500 people. Temperatures in some areas have reached more than 120 degrees. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from New Delhi.
The heat wave has so far lasted 18 days, the longest in 4 decades. For 3 weeks now, daytime highs have not dipped below 110 degrees. Some areas of northern India have recorded temperatures as high as 122 degrees. In the Pakistani village of Sibi, a temperature of 128 degrees was recorded on Friday. The heat wave has killed at least 500 people, mostly in the northern plains of India. Nearly all of the victims have died from heat stroke. The scorching heat has been compounded by widespread water shortages throughout northern India. Meteorologists say the heat wave may break soon, and in fact, today, temperatures have dropped a few degrees, offering India its first relief in nearly 1 month. This is Eric Weiner in New Delhi.
A Coast Guard cutter has rendezvoused with the cruise ship Celebration, which is adrift in the Bahamas. Technical crews are trying to restore electrical power knocked out by a fire on Sunday. For now, there's no power to cook food or run toilet facilities and air conditioners. There are 2,500 people aboard. If the power is not restored soon, the passengers will be transferred to another cruise ship tomorrow. A Florida man and a female friend were treated for injuries and then jailed after they plunged over Niagara Falls on Sunday in a barrel. It was only the second time two people have tried to ride the falls together in a barrel. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of writers find that nothing brings out their insecurities more than facing a blank page. Anne Lamott has managed to hold on to her insecurity in spite of her bestsellers. This combination of success and self-doubt leaves her in a good position to give empathic advice to other writers. There's plenty of advice in her book Bird by Bird, some instructions on writing and life. She's taught writing at the University of California at Davis and at writing conferences throughout the state. Lamott is the author of four novels, as well as the best-selling memoir, Operating Instructions, about the first year of her son's life. Maybe you remember her commentaries on Fresh Air about her life as a single mother. After the publication of Bird by Bird, we asked her to read from the beginning of the chapter about first drafts.
All good writers write really lousy first drafts. This is how they end up with good second drafts and terrific third drafts. People tend to look at successful writers, writers who are getting their books published and maybe even doing well financially, and think that they sit down at their desk every morning feeling like $1 million, feeling great about who they are and how much talent they have and what a great story they have to tell. That they take in a few deep breaths, push back their sleeves, roll their necks a few times to get all the cricks out, and dive in, typing fully formed passages as fast as a court reporter. But this is just the fantasy of the uninitiated. I know some very great writers, writers you love, who write beautifully and have a great deal of money, and not one of them sits down routinely feeling wildly enthusiastic and confident. Not one of them writes elegant first drafts. All right, one of them does, but we do not like her very much. We do not think that she has a rich inner life, or that God likes her or can even stand her. Although when I mentioned this to my priest friend Tom, he said you can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do.
That's Anne Lamott reading from her new book, Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing and Life. And you have a really nice observation about writing and then editing what you've written. You say writing is about hypnotizing yourself into believing in yourself, getting some work done, and then unhypnotizing yourself and going over the material coldly. Are you afraid that if you started writing without letting, you know, the more uninhibited part of you come out, or without like hypnotizing yourself into believing in yourself, that you would be choked by the editor in you?
Oh, definitely. And it's not just the editor, it's that raging voice of perfectionism inside of me that is terrified that I will make a mistake and disgrace the entire family. I always believe that perfectionism is the voice of the oppressor. It's not the voice of creativity or encouragement. It's the enemy of the people. And so I know that if I hold myself to good writing, I'll never get anything done.
Do you find that if you are in a more confident mood, you're going to write any better than if you're feeling particularly insecure?
Definitely. But I don't sit down in a confident mood. I need to arrive at a confident mood. And the way that I do that is by wearing down the voices of dread and self-loathing and grandiosity and all of the appearances that mental illness makes at any given day at the typewriter.
Well, now, how do you do that? That's easier said than done.
Well, I don't want to sound like a sneaker commercial, but you just do it. You know, you show up and you suit up and you sit down. And I just assume now that I'm going to have 20 minutes of heavy aerobic exercise at the desk. You know, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to get up. I'm going to think of phone calls I absolutely have to make. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to suddenly start to worry if maybe this one mole is beginning to look a little iffy. And I'll go check that out. Then I'll sit back down and I'll start to write. And it will be a very bad sentence. So I'll exit out. And suddenly I'll start to wonder whether or not it's too late for me to get orthodontia. So then I'll get up and I'll look in the mirror and I'll see if my teeth really do need work. And then I'll sit back down. And I just let myself do it. I mean, first of all, I burn off a lot of calories. And second of all, I burn off a lot of nervous energy. And then I get back down to the two principles of which I'm sure, which is, first of all, that you take really, really short assignments. And the second idea is that I let myself write really terrible first drafts. So I just have to wear it down every single day all over again.
The last time we spoke, after your book Operating Instructions came out about your son's first year of life, you talked about jealousy and what a jealous person you are. And I imagine, boy, it's so easy to
get jealous when you're writing on a day when you don't like what you're writing and you're thinking about friends who write much better than you think you're writing that day. Does jealousy interfere ever with writing for you, and does it interfere with friendships with other writers?
Well, mostly the writers I'm close to are doing a lot better than I am. Not that I'm bitter, but the fact is that I'm friends with a lot of writers who have made a great deal of money, and I mostly am not jealous of them. It's so funny, but I'm so relieved to be a writer. I was raised by a writer, and I was taught that it was a great privilege to be one of the writers in a culture. But every so often, someone will come along, and they will make me crazier than a loon because of what they drop into the conversation. And for instance, I really never just sit down at the typewriter and push back my sleeves and sit there typing away as if I'm taking dictation. It's always a struggle for me. And I had this one friend who wrote a book that I think did too well, but I thought it oversold, for instance. And Sam and I went to stay with her and her family once down in Southern California, and she'd get up very early and go to the desk and then leave her study when we all came down for breakfast. And I would say, prettily, "Well, how did it go today?" And she'd say, "Oh, it was really incredible." Like she'd been in her study having scones with Jesus or something. And I would just get apoplectic. And I finally had to cut her off. I decided I wasn't remotely well enough to be friends with her. But I think it's an occupational hazard of writers.
Anne Lamott is my guest, and she's written a new book about writing called Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing and Life. Anne, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Anne Lamott, and her new book is about writing. She teaches writing, and her new book is filled with advice about writing. It's called Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing and Life. You used to drink, and then you gave that up. What did writing do for your confidence? I'm sorry, what did drinking do for your confidence?
Drinking never helped me much as a writer, although it helped me survive a lot of nights where I felt extremely lonely and bored and misunderstood. It helped me numb the pain of that. But I woke up almost every morning for years with these hangovers that were so bad that I literally felt pinned to the bed by centrifugal force, and I would feel that there was no point trying to sit up because I was going to get slammed back to the bed. But I was young enough so that I could get up, have some coffee, take a hot shower, go for a run, have some more coffee and sit down and work. So I think it's a great myth of this culture that writing and drinking go hand in hand. And I became a much better writer when I stopped drinking. First of all, I felt like my windows really got washed. And as soon as I felt that my windows were washed, I started learning to really pay attention. And writing is about learning how to pay attention.
Your father was a writer. What kind of writing mm-hmm. did he do?
My father wrote a lot of books of nonfiction. He wrote one book called The Moneymakers or The Great Big New Rich in America. He wrote four novels. He wrote a lot for the New York Times and for West Magazine and Esquire. He was a freelance writer.
What was his full name?
Kenneth Lamott.
So growing up with a father who wrote, what were your ideas about a writer's life?
Well, there really was a long period in my life where I thought my father was mentally ill and couldn't hold down a job because he would just sit in his study every day and type. And the only other father in the neighborhood who didn't go to work had had a massive nervous breakdown, and he painted on black velvet, and I couldn't see much of a difference. And I very, very much wanted my father to leave the house every morning and wear and wear hard shoes. I thought if he would just wear hard shoes and leave the house every morning, we'd be functioning better. But every single morning at 5:30, he went into his study and he got his work done. And so he taught me a lot about showing up even when you don't want to, even when you're tired, even if you've been up too late the night before, even if you've gotten bad news the afternoon before. And he taught me that you do it as a debt of honor. If you feel this creative thing inside of you that wants out, you honor it. He taught me that you do it by prearrangement with yourself, and that you don't say, well, I hope I can get a couple hours of work done tomorrow. That instead you say, I'm going to get a couple hours of work done between these hours, and everything else can fit in around that. He taught me that you can write 300 words a day and that it will add up to something. 300 words a day is a page. And if you write a page a day and taking time off for holidays and PMS, that's probably 275 pages a year, which is a novel. He taught me that when you don't know what else to do, you just start getting down your memories. And it's like Flannery O'Connor said, that anyone who survived childhood has enough material to write for the rest of your life. And he taught me that you just sit down and you do your scales every day.
One of the real mysteries about writing is that very few people claim to enjoy the process of writing, yet so many people want to write.
Yes, and so many people want to be published. I show up on my first class of every 10-week session, and I give this wonderful, rousing pep talk on writing and how important it is that people who want to write get to work and that they find their own voice and that they learn to write awful first drafts and that they learn to write short assignments and that they learn to break through the perfectionism and that they have the right to be writers and that it will greatly increase their sense of life and of the mysteriousness of it all and that it'll help them learn to pay attention. And there's always a silence when I'm done, and then someone will raise their hand and say, but how do you find an agent? And Are manuscripts supposed to have your name at the top of every single page? And then I kind of put my head down on the table and I say, no, I don't think they need to. But it's very hard. And a lot of people felt that they were silenced as children and that they were told not to talk about what was going on in their homes between their parents, and that if they did tell the truth about what was happening, that the long, bony, white finger would come out of the sky pointing at them and say, we told you not to tell. And I tell them they have the right to tell the truth, and that all that they survive belongs to them, and that they may be able to free someone else by telling their story, and that they're probably going to sit down and have a tremendous amount to say, and that they're going to almost immediately find themselves in writer's block, but that that there are ways through it. You know, there's a great line of E.L. Doctorow's, one of the best pieces of advice about writing I've ever heard, that writing is like driving at night with the headlights on, when you can only see 2 or 3 feet in front of you, but you can make the whole journey that way. And so I try to help them just start biting off really, really small pieces of the whole, and to just work on making fragment by fragment alive and true as they can make it, and that there's a lot to be noticed and paid attention to in the world, that there's a lot that they've survived, that it's interesting, that their version of things is of value, that what they think about the night sky is important. And then, of course, I'm finished with that, and someone else will raise their hand and say, do you really need an agent, though, or can you send your manuscript directly to the publisher?
Yeah. Do you ever have writer's block?
Do I ever have writer's block? Boy, have I had writer's block over the years. But I finally realized that the words writer's block is the wrong metaphor, that you're not blocked up, that you're not stuck, that it's coming at the problem from the wrong direction, and that if your wife locks you out of the house, you're not having a problem with the door, and that the real problem is that you're empty and that you need to begin filling up. I still urge people, when they're in a period of being stuck, as I often am, to just do 300 words. That's one page, even if it's completely unusable, because it keeps their fingers from getting too arthritic. But then I convince them to go out into the world and into real life and to just fill up on all the visual images and all of the things that are going on before them, and to put a new pair of glasses on and to go look at things and strive for some sense of freshness, and to pay better attention in the checkout line at Safeway, and to go go everywhere like a ship's rat with their veined ears trembling and to just fill up and fill up and fill up. And pretty soon some steam will begin to build up in the pressure cooker again and they can sit down and plunge into a really awful first draft. And I think then that you find that you're off and running again.
So do you have to get back to the computer after we talk?
Oh, no, please.
You're free for the day now?
I'm done.
What's your writing time?
I sit down at the same time every single day because I think that it helps your subconscious to kick in for you. I start at 9:30 every single morning, and I write till about 1:30. So I budget 4 hours to try to get 2.5 hours done because I have to do all that work with the orthodontia and the moles and the phone calls that suddenly have to be made. But I do sit down at the same time every single morning.
Well, Annie, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you, Terry.
Anne Lamott is the author of Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing and Life. Our interview was first broadcast last January. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing from NPR's Nina Totenberg about a unanimous ruling today of the U.S. Supreme Court. The court ruled that the organizers of Boston's St. Patrick's Day Parade do have a right to exclude gays from the parade. Courts in Massachusetts had ruled otherwise, and the Supreme Court said today that those courts, the state courts, were in error. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about a bank merger, First Union Corporation and First Fidelity Bank Corporation, creating a very large U.S. bank. We'll also be hearing from a historian of American banking as to why so many banks in this country are called First Something. Those stories coming up soon on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says we tend to think of jazz and country western music as stylistically segregated, but that's not always true. Frankie Lane made an album with trumpeter Buck Clayton in the 50s, and Stan Kenton and Tex Ritter once recorded together. Jazz vibraphonist Gary Burton, bassist Dave Holland, and violinist Mark Feldman have all recorded with Nashville musicians. Kevin says this crossover began around 1930 with the music called Western Swing.
Milton Brown and his Brownies in 1935. If you substituted a saxophone solo for Bob Dunn's steel guitar, that could pass for a jazz record of a few years earlier. The rhythmic and harmonic language are almost identical. That tune, called Taking Off, comes from a new CD sampler, Legends of Western Swing, in Rhino Records' Hillbilly Fever series. Swing, of course, is a term usually used to describe jazz rhythm. Western swing bands like Bob Wills' Texas Playboys and others came out of the same southwestern melting pot as Count Basie's swing band. Those western musicians made no attempt to hide the inspiration they got from jazz, more like the opposite. This is from Everybody's Truckin' by the Modern Mountaineers, 1937. Hal Hebert on tenor sax. When it came to swinging, Western bands lagged behind jazz a little, but only a little. Evidence so-called hillbilly musicians listened to jazz with a critical ear. This new CD anthology contains one truly bizarre piece, a 1947 cover of Stan Kenton's theme, Artistry and Rhythm. Jazz fans tend to hear Kenton's music either as highly advanced or highly pretentious. Listen to an excerpt from Artistry in Western Swing by Tex Williams and decide for yourself if it's a tribute or a parody. Whether that's satire or not, it does anticipate John Zorn's postmodern cut-up pieces by more than 30 years. Now, country music has also influenced jazz, though you don't hear about that very much. Oklahoma's Jack Teagarden was known for his bluesy trombone, but he sang like a cowboy. These days, you'll hear country strains in the guitar playing of Bill Frisell, John Scofield, and their many imitators. Jazz's influence spread wide very quickly, and it blended with other styles from the start. Despite hybrids like jazz rock, Italian jazz, or the classically inflected third stream, jazz itself continues to thrive. Some folks will tell you jazz must remain pure in order to survive. The Western swing movement reminds us this has never been true.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Hillbilly Fever, Volume 1, Legends of Western Swing on the Rhino label. This is Boggs Boogie by Spade Cooley and his band. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional funding comes from Fairer, Strauss, and Giroux, publisher of The Coming Plague, Laurie Garrett's book about the outbreak of infectious diseases from Ebola to AIDS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with Isaac Hayes. He helped create the sound of Memphis Soul, and with his soundtrack for Shaft, he helped define the sound of action films in the 70s. For the first time in 7 years, he has a new CD. In fact, he has two of them. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.